Well, and I think this is kind of where this practice for me, which has been more performance art and dance, started developing, where I really wanted to observe the way that I move. Because just like, you know, if you examine your own thought patterns, you can start to see certain psychological frameworks. If you examine your movement patterns, you can actually know a lot about your body. Yeah, that's actually how so much of my performance art practice got built, where I really wanted to watch myself move. Right. Like, I wanted to study my own body.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Third Culture Therapy Podcast, a podcast that sits at the intersection of mental health and social identity and culture, and looks at the different ways our unique social identities impact our mental and emotional well-being. And today I am very glad to welcome on the sofa Hadar Cohen. We're going to be talking about a lot of very interesting topics: Jewish mysticism, healing, art, dance. But first, a little brief intro from me about my guest. Hadar is an Arab Jewish scholar, mystic, and an artist whose work focuses on multi-religious spirituality, politics, social issues, and community building. She is the founder of Malchut, a spiritual skill-building school teaching Jewish mysticism and direct experience of God. She teaches and consults in a variety of settings and formats, from one-on-one coaching to online group classes and in-person retreats. Her podcast, Hadar's Web, features community conversations on spirituality, healing, justice, and art. Hadar is a 10th generation Jerusalemite with lineage roots also in Syria, Kurdistan, Iraq, and Iran. Wow, welcome to the show, Hadar, from so many different places.
Thank you so much, Leila, for having me. It's an honor to be here with you.
I'm really excited about learning from you in this episode. I mean, I learned from all of my guests, but I must admit my knowledge of Judaism and Jewish mysticism in particular is quite limited. So I feel like I'm going to get a lot of information. But first, I want to start off in a way that I always do with my guests, and that's to ask you, of all of those different identities that I sort of ran through there in your intro, which one of them do you feel most closely aligned with or identify the most with?
You know, well, first, I just want to start by saying that identity can be just such a challenging thing to navigate, because on the one hand, right, it's the portal to understanding who you are and the self, but it can also kind of box you in. That's definitely, you know, something that I have had to navigate with myself over the years, is just like, when is getting into my identity and who I am actually liberating, because I can connect more deeply to myself? And where is it actually more confining and actually limits me? So to answer your question, you know, I think actually my core identity would be that of a mystic. And more precisely, I feel now it's kind of evolving into more of a devotee, which I love that phrase or that word.
What is a mystic?
Yeah. So mysticism is really translates to hidden wisdom. Right? It's wisdom that is actually all throughout life and reality, but it's hidden. It's hidden from plain sight, meaning you have to seek it, you know, and that's in some ways the basis of spirituality, is that, you know, the what we're looking for is actually already here. We just have to go through a process to see it. And I think a mystic is someone who is committed to that process, the ongoing process, right? Because there's never a full arrival into it. But someone who is devoted, really, right, to seeing, you know, reality through a deeper lens, through constantly questioning things, through understanding that, you know, what we see from our eyes, what we think in our minds, is not necessarily the full truth, that there's always deeper layers, there's hidden layers, right? This is where it also plays to me in the unconscious and the psychology and all of that. But I think also the devotee part for me is about heart-centeredness, which ties into this notion of a mystic. You know, I think that the mystic is someone who travels one of the longest distance, which is not from the earth to the moon, but is actually from the head to the heart, right? Sometimes when we think of traveling distances, we think of them spatially, mm. but I think about it through our own consciousness, right? Like, what does it look like to be caught in the mind and actually have a pathway to the heart? Right.
And how do you build that pathway? How have you built it? What practices, what is your practice?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of training, you know, because I think this is where it is kind of the hidden wisdom piece, right? Because if we don't train, we just will think that our thoughts is all that there is. But when we kind of have these moments in life, which I've certainly had, right, that all of a sudden expand our perception, maybe make us feel awe, maybe we feel love, maybe all of a sudden we feel like these things that are so inexplicable, unexplainable, or whatever you want to call it, right? So then all of a sudden there's different parts of us that are awakened. And I think for me, I've had, you know, various experiences that really expanded my perceptions of reality. And, you know, I think it's interesting because in the Western world, we have this obsession with critical thinking. Mm. Become a critical thinker, like question everything, trust your own mind, like don't let anyone. And I actually think that that has been really harmful, particularly on faith traditions, right? What it means to have faith.
Yeah.
What does it mean to actually not listen to every thought that you have and take it so seriously? I think we're actually in the Western world living in a culture that is actually obsessed with our own minds and our own thoughts and actually believes them a little bit too much.
That's a really good point.
You know what I mean? And I think that that kind of clouds, and I think that's part of why we're so sick in a lot of ways, mentally, emotionally. Because we're kind of prioritizing a very shallow, very egotistical way of understanding ourselves. That's very surface. It's very easy. It's like, oh, a thought pops into my mind. So that's what I think and that's what I am.
Mm-hmm.
But thoughts are just, you know, these kind of moments in time that in some ways are just illustrating collective consciousness in a way. To really know who you are, you have to question deeper. Where did that thought come from? Yeah. Was it from my parents? Was it from society? Mm-hmm. Was it from my trauma? Was it from my higher self? Was, you know, there's different levels of thoughts, and you only will really know the nature of those thoughts if you really kind of go deeper to where they're in the body.
It is, what you said, illustrative of collective conscious, true. It's also illustrative of things you see and hear and oftentimes subconsciously. And so then later, maybe your mind has this ability to like pop up with a thought. Doesn't really mean that that is something you should get fully attached to. But in terms of mysticism and your practice, and you've spoken about, I love that analogy of this journey from your head to your heart. But, you know, you have in front of mystic the Jewish element. So you're a Jewish mystic. And how does that differ with other mystics? And how much is your Jewish faith an integral part of you and the work that you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so first of all, right, as a devotee, I believe in the one God. That's actually part of the Jewish faith, right, the monotheistic tradition, that there is a level of like God is one. And with that oneness, there's multiple traditions and multiple paths to arrive to that. You know, I was born Jewish, so I come from a Jewish lineage. So for me, that is my portal. That's my ritual traditions. That's my access point. But, you know, I also do a lot of multi-religious work, which to me feels very important because it really is the recognition that there are multiple paths to God. And I think that when we don't have that, we can be embedded in our own tradition and get a bit fundamentalist with it of like, this is the path and this is the right way. So, you know, I'm very conscious of that, that like I'm rooted in my own lineage and there's other lineages as well. And I think that that's actually also a more honest historical telling of the development of religion. Mm-hmm. You know, we see so many parallels. I mean, of course, between Judaism, Christianity and Islam, but not just, right? Also between Judaism and Hinduism and all these different traditions. You know, we find mythology that very much parallels each other, especially in the ancient Near East. So religion was always in conversation with one another. So I think that there's a level of openness to the world and to the multiplicity of the nature of God and the remembering of who God truly is, that feels at the foundation of my religion. But with that said, is that, yeah, I have a very deep love for Judaism, which, you know, feels a bit strange to even say in this time, right? Especially because, yeah, like we're recording this. It's like, oh, been over 140 days.
4.5 months, yeah, since October 7th and everything that has followed, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the bombardment continues on, no real end in sight.
Yeah.
Jews and Muslims increasingly pitted against one another as if they are naturally born and forever sworn enemies. So I'm not really sure what you and I are doing sitting here on this sofa. Yeah. And I think we need to alert some people high up that we are not supposed to be engaging.
Yeah, like I can't believe a Palestinian Muslim woman invited me to her home. Gave me the key even to her home.
Jesus. Let's not talk about keys.
So we laugh, but sometimes in the tragedy, you do have to find some humor. And, you know, I've mentioned this before on my social media about how it's been such an incredible personal journey for me, making Jewish friends like yourself recently, at a time when really it would seem like the most inopportune time
to be making friends, although I think it's precisely for that reason that this has happened, and that it's there to kind of remind more of the connectivity and the similarities rather than the divisions, which are very clearly being sowed by many people with particular agendas. But it's interesting that you have also found this ability to look at religion as this developing and always in communication thing, which I completely agree with. Despite having grown up in a city in Jerusalem, where it is very, well, obviously literally divided between East and West Jerusalem, but also in a country that has Jewish faith as its exclusive and superior religion. So there isn't really room for that like plurality of thinking that you have. So where did that come from?
Yeah, well, it came from my lineage, lineage and memory, which is why I think colonization very much likes to rupture lineages, because that's how we actually inherit wisdom traditions. And, you know, for me, I mean, I feel very blessed and very lucky. You know, my grandparents were just such beautiful people. And I feel like I not just, right, knew their stories, but I also in some ways inherited a world in which they knew that I didn't, which, you know, but and I think about this in really interesting ways, because even though I grew up, you know, in an apartheid regime in Jerusalem, segregated city, it's like so far away from the memory of what my grandparents had of Jerusalem. I feel that because of my relationship towards my grandparents and the stories they told me, that Jerusalem was very much alive for me through memory. And I think later on, as I developed my own art through dance, somatic work, healing work, I also then realized it's also in my bones.
Yeah.
So even though my personal, you know, kind of life, you know, what I've seen, what I've witnessed from Jerusalem is very far away from that, I think I've always had this this notion of the past and the way that the past lives in me.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that it's really, I mean, two things, right? This is one of the projects that I'm working on, which is called Jerusalem in Exile, which is very much rooted in a Kabbalistic tradition of understanding that there's two Jerusalems. There's the Jerusalem of above and Jerusalem of below. You know, that's kind of something that is made into the pop culture reference, like as above, so below, right? That's a Kabbalistic teaching, that there's basically parallel worlds, that there's a spiritual world and there's a physical world. And just like in quantum, the world, it's like there's things that happen simultaneously that affect each other. The spiritual and the physical are like that. So, you know, there's a spiritual Jerusalem, which is, Jerusalem in its full power, in its manifestation of who she is, which is, right, a beloved city of God, multi-religious city, a prophetic tradition city, a devotional city, all of this. Open borders, of course, right? Because who would think about, you know, keeping people of faith away from the temple of God? That's kind of inconceivable. And then there's a physical Jerusalem, which is the racially segregated city, divided between East and West, and that very much oppresses and controls the lives of Palestinians. So it's Jerusalem is like in direct contradiction to itself.
Yeah.
You know, and I think so much of my life has been navigating these contradictions, right? On the one hand, having this faith and also having this love for Jerusalem and what the city is in her essence and what she represents and also what she could be, the potentialities of it.
Mm.
And also wrestling with the levels of really inhumane cruelty of what it is in our lived human world. And for me, being a woman of faith is not letting go of the potentialities and possibilities, right? Because if I do, then I'm forced to just be in the levels of human suffering and surrender to that as the only reality that's possible.
Yeah.
But I think like having, you know, this is for me so much of the mystical spiritual tradition. It is also, you know, having grounding in other worlds that are possible. You know, it's sometimes when I translate that into political work, I think about the role of political imagination and how necessary that is to envision other realities, right? Because if we don't have that, we can't create it.
There are a few points I want to pick up on from what you said, but first I'd like to ask you to kind of bring to life for me and for our listeners this Jerusalem of your grandparents that you speak of and that has carried on in you and your bones, as you put it.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, so first of all, my grandparents were some of the most, they were so in love. Like, you know, and I remember, you know, my grandma had like 10 siblings. My grandpa had 10 other siblings. And between all of them, the consensus was is that like they were the most special couple in Jerusalem because they were just, they were really in love. And I think for me, I also just associate Jerusalem with that romantic love that they shared, which was so potent for me in my upbringing. And, you know, my grandfather was a chazan, which is prayer leader in a synagogue. And his lineage, his grandma was from Aleppo. And in that time, right, the Aleppo and Jerusalem tradition and the Jewish musical liturgical tradition is quite similar. Yeah, I guess I'll start with my grandpa. I mean, I think that he was just so devotional and so God-centered and also so non-judgmental, like really this like level of openness to all. And, you know, when he was a pillar of the community, and when he died, I inherited so much of his stuff, which was such a gift, like all the tapes of him singing all these music, notebooks, but then also just like all these letters of what people wrote about him when he passed. And I remember one person wrote, he's like, I don't know, I don't really believe in God. I'm kind of an atheist. Like, I don't really understand what this whole religion thing is about. But when I hear you sing, I feel what you feel. And I feel your heart and it moves me. And you were my connection to God, you know? Yeah, I mean, there was parts of it that made me see myself in it because obviously I'm very God-centered. But it also, you know, it really roots me in an Arab Jewish lineage, because part of what makes, for me, my relationship to Jerusalem feel really potent is the level of devotion, you know? Like, it's not a coincidence that this city has so many prophets that have had direct channels to God, you know, that this is the land by which so many religions were started and developed. Like, there's, and that devotion is not, you know, it's not just this, oh, religious law, and now you do this and now you do that, right? It's expressed in so many ways. It's expressed in wisdom traditions, which, you know, this is also something that I really honor about my grandparents. is a certain level of like multiculturalism, right? That like spirituality is in harmony with science, which is in harmony with the arts, which is in harmony with math and poetry, and all of these different fields are just different expressions of wisdom traditions. And why not just explore all of them?
Right. But when were your grandparents in Jerusalem? I mean, presumably if it's 10th generation, then they were there pre-1948.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like, for them, their experience, what was Jerusalem like then?
Yeah, well, yeah, so they were born in the 30s. And my grandma, you know, she would always tell me this story. I mean, she had Palestinian friends till the day she died. And that was always something that kind of stayed intact for her. But I remember she would tell me this story when she was a little girl. I think she was about, like, 10 years old or something, and maybe a little bit older. But you know, after school, she would always go to her neighbor, who was Palestinian Muslim, and they would just, like, play, hang out, eat, and hang out, you know. And one time, she went over, just like she generally did, and, you know, they were just close. And her friend's mother was just like, you can't really come here anymore. It's not safe. And that was kind of that. And it's interesting, when my grandma would tell me this story, I just remember just that feeling, which was kind of familiar for me, you know, growing in Jerusalem, being like a 10-year-old girl and being so confused, like, why can't I play with Palestinian Muslim children? Like, what's going on? They're my neighbors. Like, shouldn't we just be able to, like, hang out? And then just kind of being told, like, it's not safe, don't do it.
Right.
And not really told why.
Yeah.
And just kind of exerting this very strong boundary. And, you know, I think that there's also ways that I wish that I asked my grandma way more questions about her life.
We always wish that.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
We always wish
after they're gone that we, like, just sat for hours and recorded everything. But yeah.
Totally. But I think for me, it's that, like, even if I don't know the exact stories, I know the feelings and the experience, and, you know, like, and I think especially, I mean, one of the things that makes me really, really sick these days, especially with witnessing Israeli society, is just, like, the level of such, like, deep Islamophobia, especially, right, in Mizrahi Arab Jewish community, which is so, so, so foreign to me. Like, my grandparents were, you know, devotional people and just had so much love and devotion to Islam also as a religion, you know, like, they it was in harmony with Judaism. Yeah. It was, and that's how I grew up, you know. I have so much respect and admiration for Islam, and yeah, it's really harsh to witness, I mean, the levels of just complete distortion of both my lineage, but also the ways in which it just obviously harms Muslims, Palestinians, Arabs, and creates such a distorted narrative and framework of who they are as people. And I think for me, when I kind of, you know, started becoming more public and outspoken about Palestine, you know, it wasn't just coming from this place of, like, oh, solidarity with Palestinians because Palestinians deserve freedom, which of course they do. It was also coming from a place of, actually, this is part of restoring my lineage as well.
Yeah.
And the way, you know, when I first kind of felt free Palestine in my bones was actually at an ancestral session that I did. The practitioner was kind of guiding me through this, like, somatic experience of connecting with, like, ancestors, you know, like 20, 30 generations back, and communicating with them, right? Like, all this spiritual
stuff.
Spiritual stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I think for me, I really felt the Free Palestine call come from my own ancestry.
Wow.
And that's why I felt like I could really trust it. You know?
Did you always identify as an Arab Jew, or did that come later in life? And if so, how did it come about?
Yeah, that came on later in life. I grew up very confused about my identity. Yeah, I mean, listen, I remember as a child, teenage girl, I just experienced so much shame around my identity. And I think that's very common for Arab Jewish people who live under Israeli society, right? Because part of Zionism was uprooting Arabness from Jewishness.
Yeah.
Right? And I mean, it's quite heartbreaking and sad, the levels of success that it had in doing that. I mean, even thinking about like the Arabic language, right? There's like Judeo-Arabic. Arabic is also a Jewish language. Mm-hmm. There were Jewish scholars who were writing in Arabic. And because now the majority of Arab Jews actually don't speak Arabic, you know, that was lost in like two generations. We also don't have access to our own traditions as much. But, you know, going back to your question is that, in Israeli society, especially when I was growing up, now the dynamics are a bit different, but if you listen to Arabic music at home, that was not something you talked about publicly.
Right.
You know, that made you like the enemy.
Right.
So you kind of grow up wanting to hide your roots.
Right.
And I did that, actually. I remember when we moved to the U.S. and people asked me, I pretended I was Ashkenazi.
Right. Wow.
For a while, actually, because I felt embarrassed. I felt embarrassed of who I was. I didn't know why my family was like more barbaric, you know. Now we're kind of joking about reclaiming barbaric vibes, but yeah, I mean, you know, it takes a really deep toll on you. Mm-hmm. Right, these forms of racism, and yeah, you know, like I also grew up very much like my family has all sorts of mixed feelings about our identity and, you know, the ways that they internalize these different forms of racism. But my mom definitely, you know, wanted me to succeed in life, just like all moms do. And she wanted me to get into the university system. She's like, one of the things she said, you know, she was like, I always dreamed that, you know, my parents would be professors or come, you know. So, like, really pushing me into, like, an Ashkenazi model of success. Mm-hmm. And I very much had that in my teenage years. So I was very much, like, drinking the, like, in Hebrew we call it lihishtaknez, which means to become Ashkenazi, like, assimilate into Ashkenaziness. Just, like, adopting the ways of being, adopting, you know.
Yeah.
I was so interested in Western philosophy, and I was reading, like, Kant and Hegel, and I'm like, yes, get me to the academy. You know, I was like, I can do this, like, yeah, and...
And then what happened?
Well, what happened then? I mean, so many things to happen, and I think the crash was, like, slow over time. You know, I always had my love of my grandparents, and my grandparents were super against becoming Ashkenazi. You know, within my kind of 10 siblings and each, like, no one married Ashkenazi.
Right.
And that's part of a dynamic within Mizrahi community in Israeli society that you really see, like, the people who intermarried basically lost their roots.
Right.
And the people who didn't kept it.
Okay.
So that was like a very strong thing for a long time, is that like we do not intermarry with Ashkenazim, which, right, you know, I still have that in my, you know, my grandma's voice in the background, like, do not date an Ashkenazi. But I've softened up over the years. but it's just intense because it represents the loss of your lineage.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can say the story in so many different ways, but I think really it was through relationships with Palestinians that allowed me to see the beauty of my lineage. And I remember specifically one Palestinian friend from Jerusalem who, he just came back from Egypt. He was there in university, and, you know, that was right around the time of the Arab Spring, and he came and he was part of, you know, Jerusalem social justice crowd, and he gave a talk about, you know, the Arab Spring in Egypt. So I was like, okay, like, I want to go. I want to learn. I was the only Arab Jew in that space. And then afterwards, you know, I asked questions, I engaged, and I said, like, yeah, I'm an Arab Jew. And just remembering his face, he was just, like, jaw-dropped. And he's like, whoa, an Arab Jew? I've never met someone who identifies as an Arab Jew. Can we get coffee and chat? And, you know, at that time, I was still kind of, it was new to carrying that term. You know, I read Ella Shohat. I read, you know, there's all these amazing Arab Jewish scholars that I was reading. I was learning. I was finding other people who were going through that same questioning. But it was still something that I was like, can I fully claim this? What is this? What does this mean? And yeah, I mean, that particular friendship, you know, he was a very supportive friend in my journey. You know, he like sent me the, you know, Edward Said essay where he's talking about a Palestinian Jew and what happened to him. And he basically told me, like, I always wondered what happened to the Palestinian Jews. And like, you know, and you go to, you know, you read some stuff about Palestinian history and there's Jews there.
Obviously.
But no one's talking about what happened to that community.
It's true.
You know, and all of a sudden he was like, you're alive. Yeah.
You are found one.
Literally.
Like a fossil. Yeah.
Like found. Like and you know, Ariella Aisha Azoulay, who's also a Palestinian Jewish scholar, writes about this where she's just like, we kind of became this like extinct species because we all of a sudden became, there was so much unbelonging and we became irrelevant. But anyways, that was just like one example of many, but just feeling all of a sudden, I think with my relationship with many Palestinians over time, I felt so much love and care, both for like who I am and my lineage, but also of my process of like re-Arabizing, you could say. We don't have to go into that charge understanding of that term. But, you know, coming from an Israeli society that really sees Arab identity as something so demonic and so barbaric and so uncivilized and all, you know, all the things, it really felt so radical to say, no, actually, I think there's something beautiful in Arabness. And I actually am one of them.
Yeah, I mean, it is definitely very radical for someone in your position. I mean, it's probably radical for anyone who is Arab, especially these days, because the Arab world is in such a bad state. Most people are like trying to run away from the association, not like run towards it. But although I'm very proudly Arab, and I do understand that journey of kind of
reclaiming some of the confused and disparate, disjointed parts of yourself into one like whole within you.
But it is particularly radical in your case, because obviously you are, dominant structure is a sort of racist exclusive one that prioritizes Jews above all else. But then among that you have the like rankings, as you rightly pointed out, Mizrahi, Ashkenazi, etc. And then you within this have gone against the grain and kind of singled yourself out. And within that sort of hierarchy system, you've identified yourself, at least according to their logic, the system's logic, as less than. And then on top of that, you're also anti-Zionist. So you're really then carving out a very special niche for yourself.
And then I talk about God, which is a whole other...
Then you also talk about God. A lot of the chutzpah, right? As they call it, as they say, is that Ashkenazi or Mizrahi?
It's more Ashkenazi.
It's more Ashkenazi. I thought it was like, it's more American.
But
there is that radical element, which is obviously incredibly powerful. But all of the other things you've described before, or that journey, you know, I've heard a lot of shame and a lot of loss and trying to heal that. And I wanted to understand a little bit your journey towards healing that. You've touched on some of the things that you've done, and obviously God and your faith and involving in that, and then also certain healing practices that I know you've also studied yourself, but some that you have also done.
What of them have been the most profound for you, and what is it that you like to practice the most to kind of help with that healing?
Well, for me, first of all, healing is a certain return to self. Whatever that self, right? The self always kind of remains a mystery of like, who am I? Who is the self? But I really do fundamentally believe, and I had to have a long journey of this, right? Because I think that, you know, there's so much, especially coming from the background that I came from, and then coming to the U.S. and, you know, in the Western world around healing. And I was part of so many different communities of like meditation and Buddhism and energy healing and New Age spirituality, where like it's mostly white. And I just felt like there was something wrong with me for having this level of trauma, that there's not really adequate literature to address in the Western world. A lot of the trauma conversation goes into childhood development.
Yeah.
What happened to you as a child? What did your parents do to you? And, you know, I was coming from collective trauma, big ancestral collective trauma of multiple lineages. And I think that for a while, I just felt very kind of like, oh, I'm broken. I need someone to fix me, right? That kind of healing journey. And I just wanted to basically try every healing modality under the sun.
Yeah.
And I think especially the last few months have been incredibly humbling. I mean, in so many ways, because and really even just last night, I had this new understanding of this where, like, healing is not necessarily this destination that we arrive at, because that's an impossibility in some level, so long as we're human. And thinking more about what does it mean to be in a really intense rupture and just actually be in it. Like, that to me is actually healing, and in line with my spiritual tradition, which is really about how do I be as present with what is exactly in the way that it is, right? And not bringing the past or the future or, you know, but actually this level of presence, which I do believe that, you know, presence is also actually another word for God, you could say, right? This quality of presence. I think there's something so deeply healing there. And, you know, in terms of what I've found, I mean, a couple of things, right? I mean, I do so many practices, but I mean, of course, meditation. To me, meditation feels so core, because just like what we were saying in the beginning, like, our thoughts run us and we think we're in control of them, but we're really not. And when we take this pause, like, I think moments of pause are so incredibly important, because that's when we shift from being in reactivity to being in more agency and response. And unless we have that pause, we're just on the wheel. We can't get off.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's also been very much about understanding the body, which to me is a very deep mystery. Like, what is this body that we're in? You know, it's quite amazing, because we live in it our whole lives and we still don't really know how to move with it.
Or to really tap into it, to feel it, or to interpret it. I think we still struggle a lot to interpret what our body is telling us, and to be really in tune with it, because it's giving us signals all the time. It's just that we can often be obtuse or ignore. I mean, obviously we ignore things, but, like, honestly, there are a lot of people who just really don't understand how to do that sort of engagement with the body. We haven't been taught to understand beyond some still basic things, like your tummy grumbles, so you're hungry, you know? But beyond that, there's so many other things that our body is telling us.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is kind of where this practice for me, which has been more performance art and dance, started developing, where I really wanted to observe the way that I move. Because just like, you know, if you examine your own thought patterns, you can start to see certain psychological frameworks. If you examine your movement patterns, you can actually know a lot about your body.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, you're just walking and you think you're just moving, you're getting coffee. It's just movement to you. You're not thinking about it. But the way you're moving actually tells you quite a lot, right? Whether, like, you're hunched over, whether you're, how your hands are moving, which one moves forward, which one moves back. You know, like, there's so much to examine there. And, yeah, that's actually how so much of my performance art practice got built, where I really wanted to watch myself move.
Right.
Like, I wanted to study my own body. And I still, I'm a bit, like, obsessed with that question, right? Because it's like, we can't really see ourselves.
Yeah.
Unless we look at a mirror, but then there's a certain level of, like, you know, the observer kind of dictating. But I think that there's something really interesting, you know, instead of just letting the mind run, it's like, what does it look like to let the body move, just organically move however it wants to, whether it's, you know, like, large movements, small movements, it doesn't really matter, but, like, allowing a certain movement in the body and witnessing it, like, being with it, you know? And there's actually a lot of beauty there when the body can be itself without this, like, critical examination lens. So for me, that has been probably the most healing thing. It's a very personal practice of just being with my own body.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I've actually never talked about it this way, so.
Well, it's interesting. I haven't heard it really spoken of this way. And sort of similar to you, I went through a period in my life where I was like, God, something is deeply sort of
painful and broken inside. And I don't really know what, it doesn't really correlate with my like so-called lived experience, as people coin it. But, you know, like my childhood was, you know, lovely, nice parents, house, etc. I felt it very deeply that it was this ancestral sort of, again, a lot to do with rupture and losses and things carried down. And I tried many, many things, similar to healing and all sorts of modalities, but I haven't, it's only very recently that I've sort of looked at the body connection and definitely not as much as where you are at in your exploration and discovery. But it's like I'm now almost entering like, oh, this is a door, this is a room I haven't properly explored before. Like, what does connecting and understand what my body is saying and doing, the flow as you spoke about, that's really interesting. Even now, just trying a couple of new somatic practices, but also new into that practice. So I'm also interested to see how that kind of develops and unfolds. I want to ask you, well, I started most sort of want to bring it to the contemporary moment, but also in keeping with your upbringing. Like, you grew up obviously in Jerusalem in a country that is Zionist rule, has, you know, legally occupied large parts of the country, arguably all of it, since 1948. And operates an apartheid system, and you've, you know, touched on sort of growing up being a bit confused by that, also understanding your own particular Mizrahi hierarchy in that mix. But when and how did you become fully aware that you were growing up in a system that was fundamentally, like, there was something wrong here, there was something like fundamentally wrong and unjust and inhumane, as you also described it? And how do you reconcile, in a way, your deep love for this city that you have with also the great pain that is inflicted on many people there on a day-to-day basis?
I mean, I think for me, you know, I guess, and this is not so dissimilar from a lot of other people, I mean, obviously, particularly Arabs, but I just feel, especially in the last few months, just a constant shock of just how disconnected the public conversation of Palestine is from what's actually happening on the ground. There's a lot of fantasies that people have about what Zionism is or, you know, yeah. And I think it's just, I mean, so many people have spoken about it, but it's just so clear when you're on the ground, when you go to the West Bank, like, it's not something that's just, like, so hidden. It's actually absolutely in plain sight. I think the, I mean, it is so, you know, I'm such a sensitive person, very empathetic, very loving, and to witness what Palestinians, you know, for me, it was more in the West Bank, to, like, really witness what they have to go through. I mean, that level of, like, psychological and physical torture and insanity, really, it's just, there's no question about it. And, you know, I can share my own development process of, like, what I watched, what I read, what I saw. It feels less relevant to me because I feel, and maybe, I don't know, maybe other people would say different things, that it's actually really relevant to learn about these processes. I mean, you know, since I was 18, you know, I was dating someone who was Jewish guy, and he was going to, you know, Sheikh Jarrah, like, every Friday there was protests at 4 right before Shabbat to, like, show solidarity against the Israeli occupation and against the forced displacement. So, like, since 2010, you know, which is so wild to just feel, like, how ongoing this level of violence is, and just how every day since I was born, it's gotten worse. And, you know, there's always kind of this thing that, I mean, I certainly feel, I'm sure many people feel as well, that, you just don't think that it can get worse. And then every day it gets more and more worse.
Yeah.
And the level of like heartbreak and tragedy and pain and suffering, and you want to make it stop. You don't know how, because I mean, it really feels like people are just so indoctrinated into a fantasy world that is far removed from reality. There's so many reports about just the levels of brutality and control. So, like, factually, it just feels like there's no question.
Right. And then also, how does that for you feel like when you're there and you're like, do you not see what I'm seeing? Like,
yeah.
When because we know, unfortunately, like, your perspective is in the minority.
Yeah.
And that still, even now, even with this horrific genocide ongoing, still the majority of the public in of Israeli society are for, like, the continuation, right, like, the continued destruction of Gaza. Not only of Gaza, but of, like, forget Palestinians, peace, two state, one state, no state, just go away. General feeling.
Totally.
You know, how is that also for you? Like, you're there and you're part of this powerful majority, but you're also like this weirdo minority within it. And you're like, but I'm seeing this in front of me with my own eyes. How are you not? And where does that put you in relation to, again, the sort of society around you, your identity, your sense of belonging? Like,
yeah. Well, so first I want to say that, and I know this is different for different Jewish activists, I feel pretty blessed and lucky on this front, because I never felt like I was just the only one or the individual speaking out. Partially maybe because I'm so community oriented, you know, I had especially Arab Jewish scholars, like so many mentors, so many teachers, so many guides, you know, academics, thinkers, like, and for me, you know, because my mom was pushing me into the Ashkenazi academia, like I really read a lot.
Right.
And I connected with a lot of professors and developed there, and, you know, especially Arab Jewish academics, I mean, there's no question, none of them are denying, I wouldn't say none, but the vast majority, right, but then I would also say that I think in terms of the Israeli society and the friend group, I mean, like, all my Israeli friends are very anti-Zionist, and we do have a community, and there are people that are brilliant and that I love and respect and have taught me, and I've taught them, and, you know, so I never felt like, oh, I was just, like, the only one.
Yeah.
I felt very, you know, there were so many initiatives that were going on, you know, whether it's like protecting Palestinians who are, you know, in the West Bank and, protecting Palestinian shepherds from Israeli military violence, from settlers, and Masa Fariata, right? There's Israeli groups that go, American Jewish groups that go and protect. So, I mean, and even in the American Jewish community, I just feel like I was actually surrounded by a lot of anti-Zionist Jewish people, which I know is actually not common, because I think for a lot of Jewish people on their anti-Zionist journey, they feel like they're the only ones. And then they're like, oh, I need, which is part of why for me, I feel community is so important, because when you realize you're actually like, you don't have to give up your belonging, you could actually belong
even more. Yeah. No, I love that you really centered that answer. Centered community in your answer, because, you know, it's been the most consistent answer I've had from every guest on the on this podcast when I ask them, like, what sort of has helped you the most with your mental and emotional well-being, and whatever tools they've used, therapy, alternative, psychedelics, whatever, like, the community part, it really plays like a big role. And you saying this in this context also just goes to show, when you say community, again, it doesn't always look like what you think it looks like. Mm-hmm. But it is really actually about, like, the values that you connect on. And then when you have that, you feel a lot safer and a lot held, and you're able to kind of embody yourself more truly.
Yeah.
You know, which ties back into what you were saying earlier, this return to self. And that is healing.
Yeah.
And if you're able to be yourself and be that wholly around other people who, like, love and carry you and align with you, then you feel even more powerful to be able to
yeah.
I guess, carry on.
So I want to touch on anti-Semitism with you. A big problem historically. It's also contemporarily. You haven't touched on that yet so far as a source perhaps of trauma or in your lineage, ancestrally or otherwise, and that maybe because of particular historic facts, and it was quite different in the Arab world treatment of Jews than it was in Europe. But I wanted to ask you that it is obviously a real and valid concern, and one that has existed, unfortunately, for hundreds of years, and as we know, culminated in the horrific genocide of the Holocaust, the Nazi Holocaust, during World War II. At the same time, it is positioned as very much a reason why Israel must exist as an exclusively Jewish state for the safety of Jews. At the same time, I was speaking with you, and you very much identifying with your Arab Jewish history, having Palestinian Arab friends, more importantly, being anti-Zionist. How do you grapple with these very contradictory elements of the fact that nowadays anyone who is anti-Zionist is considered anti-Semitic, whilst also having anti-Semitism being a real issue to also grapple with, but you being against the system that is supposedly the answer to it?
Yeah, great question. And it's really hard to talk about, I'm not going to lie, because, I mean, especially with other Arabs, sometimes it's really hard to talk about anti-Semitism in a serious way, because there's a lot of reactivity, which I could totally understand where that comes from, right? Because Arabs are constantly told that they're being anti-Semitic when they stand up for Palestinian rights. So there becomes this big aversion to talking about anti-Semitism in a serious way. There's so much that I could say. I mean, first I want to start with the personal, that like anti-Semitism and just, I don't want to say anti-Semitism, but what I want to say is Jewish pain something that is very deep in my body. Mm-hmm. Very, very deep. And you know, I think probably in a lot of Jewish bodies, right? And for me, I think that's part of why I'm actually so committed to spirituality, is because I refuse for my lineage to be that of pain, right? And I think that this is where there's a lot of actually similarities with Palestinian lineages, right? That it's not just about the oppression, it's also about the resilience. And, you know, I do believe that Jewish wisdom was developed in highly oppressive realities.
Yeah, it was.
And I can focus on the oppression and the othering and the unbelonging, which sometimes I might. But I could also focus on what was developed through that, which is really beautiful wisdom traditions, community-oriented practices that are so resilient, you know, like being able to really survive as a people for so long and still have such core practices. I mean, there's something so, so beautiful there. And I do actually connect with that into the Jewish spirituality because, you know, I think when there's so much pain and suffering in your physical body and your physical experience, you do often go to other realms. And I think that that possibilities of Jewish mystical development through that is something that I honor. Now, of course, that's not the whole story because obviously also Jewish mysticism developed in also very beautiful conditions like Andalusia and, you know, in shared partnership with Muslims around different pathways to God and music and dance and, you know, all these other forms. So it's not just that, but I think that for me, I am really interested in creating a new paradigm and a new world. That's my commitment.
Yeah.
And that means that we have to have new ways of thinking about things. I think about this a lot, that this is really the first time in history, with maybe minor exceptions like Morocco and small communities in Tunisia, that like Jews are not really growing up embedded in Muslim communities.
Right.
Which is a huge rupture to our own lineage. And so much of our understandings of who we are is being used by bigger governmental systems to, yeah, for Islamophobic purposes, for the continued oppression of Palestinians, things that are just so out of line with my own tradition. So it feels like a betrayal.
Right.
It feels, and you know, sometimes I do even cry about this when I, because I've had, especially over the last few months, you know, Palestinian Muslims, Arab Muslims who've been so demonized, have been so attacked in their workplace, on the streets, on the this, for being a Muslim or being Palestinian in the name of Judaism.
Yeah.
And there's something that is just so heart-shattering and so heartbreaking for me, because I'm like, that's not my tradition. Yeah. That's not my way. So it becomes really hard, especially in the communities where, you know, like with Arab and Muslim communities who they're attacked for being anti-Semitic wrongfully, you know, because they're speaking up for Palestine. Then they do in some ways kind of, some of them, I'm not saying all of them, but right, there is a pattern of just being like, well, I don't want to talk to Jews because I don't want.
Yeah.
You know, it just kind of, this is a cycle that feeds.
Yeah.
And I guess what I want to say is that I'm really interested in breaking these cycles.
Yeah.
And in order for me to do that, you know, I think that, that there's a Talmudic passage that talks about pain.
Mm.
And it has a couple of different metaphors, but one of them is like about two boats. And let's say two boats like come right at each other, and there's only actual like a path for one to go. So what do? Like, you know, because if they both go at the same time, they'll crash and it won't be a thing, right? So they have to basically choose who goes first, and the other goes, and then once they pass, the other goes. And that's kind of a metaphor for justice and pain,
right?
Which I think is really interesting, because so often we're so caught in, well, I want to speak about my trauma and I don't feel seen and I don't feel belonging and I don't feel this. And we kind of in the I.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a spiritual person, I believe that part of collective liberation is making space for everyone's struggles and everyone's pain and everyone's suffering and everyone's oppression. And there is room for that because God is the most infinite, merciful one. And that's a faith belief that I have, but we do have to choose kind of who goes first.
Yeah. You know,
because if we go at the same time, we're not going to meet each other and we're going to crash and burn.
Yeah.
But if I say, actually, I can hold that I have grief, trauma, pain, whatever you want to call it, that I do actually want to be witnessed by a friend, by the world, but I'm also recognizing that they also have that and that same desire, then I feel like there's a certain level of spiritual maturity. And not everyone can do this, but there is something beautiful about having that humility to say, I'm going to let you go first, actually.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you pass by. I'm going to witness. I'm going to hold. And not by abandoning my own self.
Yeah.
But by knowing that that's part of what needs to happen. And I think especially in this moment, you know, this is part of my own relationship to anti-Semitism and the discourse. Like, I just think that it's so hard to actually have an honest conversation about anti-Semitism on the global public space right now,
yeah,
especially with the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Mm. So, and the levels of pain and suffering. I mean, you know, I have Palestinian friends who've lost like 50 members of their family. It's like, I'm not going to now come and tell them about.
The conversation around anti-Semitism, one feels now, has been so muddied because of its conflation with anti-Zionism, and this conflation of a whole religion with one state, really a regime that's barely 75 years old. You know, like, it's like a blip in the ancient history of Judaism for it to suddenly be like sitting right at the top and in complete control is quite something. So then to really have, as you say, an honest conversation about it is quite difficult, even though it very well ought to be had, especially, well, actually around the world in different, for different reasons and in different ways. I really love that example you gave of the boats, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I think actually that maybe having the ability to be able to see and carry both your pain and someone else's and understand a little bit how to navigate that comes actually from doing some of the personal work and doing some of the personal healing. And while I've come to, within my own journey, appreciate more community work and the need for it, and there are some people who actually are quite against sort of this individualistic type personal healing and more about like all healing should be done community, I think there's scope for both. I think there are times when you do have to be on your own and like slay your own demons for a while, and then and then you can maybe get some other people in your tribe and go off and slay some more. But I feel much more capable now to witness and hold not competing things. I don't think it's competing pains. It's more like I can hold multiple truths in my mind and in my heart at once and without them conflicting, because I feel like I've made space for that.
Yeah.
And I made space for it because I dealt with some of the things that were not like I've dealt with the pain and it's gone. It's more the triggers within me that weren't fully processed, mm-hmm. such that, because it should be possible for me to witness, see, be like, yes, you have been harmed and I have been harmed. And now we, like, how do we get out of harm's way? Not, no, you weren't harmed, I was harmed. You know, like, why does it have to be a no? Like, it's fine. There is actually space. Like, insofar as there's enough space for love, like, there is also, unfortunately, enough space for pain. Like, yeah. It's, like, continuous. It really, you think you can't endure something, then something worse, and there's more and more and more, as we are witnessing today, like, day in, day out. So I think it's a really kind of lovely way to try and navigate the space, and maybe a kind of call to people, in a way, something that I try to encourage through these conversations is for people to take care of themselves and to look at what's going on within themselves and to recognize how much not doing that can in and of itself be a selfish act, really. It really can. You think you're, oh, am I just taking care of myself? Well, trust me, like, please do, because if you don't, it may come out in very harmful ways, in projections of which, like, if you multiply it, one person and then into a city, into a population, you have, fortunately, what we're seeing now in Israel, which I think is a very highly traumatized but weaponized trauma society that hasn't really, in my mind, gone through a healing process. It's gone through a protective process, an armored process, but not really a healing process.
I love what you said, and I think you've written about this publicly really beautifully as well, about your own healing journey and being like what that makes possible in your levels of viewing and relationship. And I think that's really core. You know, there's so much to say about the way that our own psychology and then the political discourse, the way that they're enmeshed, and sometimes we think we're doing activism, but really we're just working out our own personal wounds.
Yeah, that's very true.
And it becomes really destructive in the political conversation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 100%.
So we really need a lot more healing techniques and skills.
Yes.
For sure. I'm really grateful for all the work that you do and hosting these conversations. I think it's so, 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 so critical. We have to learn how to hold space for one another,
yes.
especially in the Arab community, you yes. know, because I mean, we're all in pain. There's no question about it. There's just no question how it manifests, how, you know, what's the exact story. There's nuances, there's differences, of course. But we need to like learn how to do this relational care, because so often, you know, and I think that right, the Israeli psyche structure just feeds, I mean, first of all, it feeds off of fear, but it the cycle that it goes on is like attack, defense, attack, defense, attack,
yeah.
defense, attack,
yeah.
you know, and I don't know how it doesn't get boring to the people who are doing it. It's just like, how much can you be in that same, right? But I think it's interesting the way that sometimes our psychology mirrors that, right? We say we want to decolonize, we want to demilitarize, we want to out of this military loop. But then sometimes in our personal relationships, we're attacking, defending, right? And there's like this mirror psychological process that I've witnessed that can happen in relational dynamics. Which goes back to like that space of pause that spirituality get. Like, what if you didn't need to defend yourself, right? Like,
yeah.
there's a phrase that says like, when you're in a place of defending yourself, you've already kind of disempowered yourself because you're
yeah.
validating the need to defend. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's a good point. Yeah, I like that.
And when you're attacking, obviously that comes from your own insecurities.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, one of the things that I mourn a lot, both in Jewish and Palestinian community, and this is obviously something that's just the left in general, but just the ways that we're so harsh with each other relationally, you know? And I really do believe that a liberatory politics, you know, if we have these grand visions of what we want to shift in the world, especially these massive systems of oppression and suffering, we have to start embodying new ways of being with ourselves and with each other.
Yeah, to me,
that's kind of the only way. I think that sometimes when we look at systems of oppression, specifically the military system, it can feel so giant and we can feel so small and hopeless in how we shift it and transform it. But I think it's also really important to remember that there's systems that are bigger than that. And to me, that is God. God, to me, the most powerful being. And if you want to talk about who God is, come to my God fellowship. I teach what that word means. But really, spirit, right? Like the way that intelligence moves through reality. Like there's something really, really great and deep there. And also land consciousness, the way that land communicates with, you know, other lands, and the way that land actually speaks to us. Like, I actually think that there's so many more powerful forces out there, and that the more that we align ourselves, right, with God, with the land, with these greater powers, it's a lot easier to see a path to liberation, right, as opposed to being so caught in, like, the way, because that's exactly what the military system wants us to think, that we are small and that the only way to survive is by picking up arms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one narrative. There's other narratives out there. And I think that the more that we expand our understanding of who we are as humans, and the more that we connect to those greater forces, the more powerful we become.
Yeah, it's true. It is true. It's true. I agree with you. We often think in these very big macro, change the world, topple the systems. And while that may be the case, ultimately, that's the goal. But we really take for granted how where the beginning steps are really with yourself and then those around you. And then you start working outwards like that. You don't go... You don't cast the net all the way out across the globe and then try and reel it in. You do it sort of from in out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you do have an impact, I believe. I think what I really like about these conversations as well and about your work and just also your embodying of yourself as this person who is, you know, very rooted in her heritage and lineage, reclaiming it, honoring it, promoting it, and like with pride, but it's also a very inclusive thing. It's not exclusive. I feel like when you call yourself an Arab Jew, there's just so many people who get included into that mix, and like it's a rich, it speaks of like a lot of richness, but more importantly for me, it offers a new way of looking and visualizing the future. It's like a new imagination, and something I often think is a big issue that we have when it comes to Israel-Palestine and the dialogue around it is a very unimaginative one, i.e. it's very limited in scope. You hear things like, you know, two-state or Zionist, not Zionist, but there's just not a very creative way of looking at how a land and a people can live. So I really like that you, for me, are like a kind of embodiment of that. Like you're a walking example of like, yeah, this is what it could be, actually, exactly like this. And everyone else is like, oh, it's so complicated and it's not possible. It's like, well, actually, maybe you need to expand your mind.
I mean, and I think if you just look at the land itself, I mean, this is a whole other part of my work, which is also where I have also derived my politics from, which is actually just relationship with the land.
Yeah.
What does the land want? What does that mean to actually be devoted to a land? It's a whole other different conversation than like what I want or what my trauma is or what my ego is. It's like, well, how do I honor the land? You know, I believe that land is a being, it's consciousness, yeah. You know, like there's wisdom in it. So what is that listening like? And I think it's just, yeah, I mean, that's also for me, I get frustrated, because the discourse can get, so rigid. And also sometimes very much pretending as if like no one has ever thought about what possibly might be a solution.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, it's so complex. It's an ancient struggle. It will go on forever. Let's just ignore it.
you know? Yeah.
That's kind of how the majority, I would say, definitely Western media, like when it's convenient, we'll make it like a fashion show where people can come around and ooh, ah, or whatever. But, you know, there's been so many beautiful scholars, thinkers, activists, artists who have been envisioning and re-envisioning, because I really think that is what's required of us, right? We can't get stuck in the past because things keep evolving and changing. So we have to be like, okay, we thought this could work. It's not working. We got to re-envision, right?
Yeah.
We have to constantly re-envision depending on what's happening.
Yeah, it's true.
And we can't, you know, this is part of what's frustrating around, like sometimes you see people now are talking about two-state solution and it's just like, you have not caught up.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You're stuck in the 90s. Like,
yeah.
So just like this way of like, actually there's so much possibility, but we actually have to meet the moment as it is and yes. not from like a certain historicized lens of like 20 years ago or 500 years or wherever it is that people's trauma minds are stuck in.
Which brings back to the whole being of presence and really honoring and understanding that you are where you are in this moment is actually something to be fully experienced and then create imagination and new imaginings from there.
Yeah, and I will say just one thing about the Arab Jewish identity that you said about it being also a very future oriented one. I mean, that for sure is something that we talk a lot in Arab Jewish community, right? Because sometimes people, you know, get upset that people claim themselves as Arab Jews and they're like, well, that was historically inaccurate because, you know, and of course we can have so many conversations about the development of Arab identity and what is Arab identity of itself, like disconnected from Jewishness. But to me, claiming myself as an Arab Jew, it's not just, oh, my ancestors were Arab Jews. It's like, I'm an Arab Jew, and I also want to envision a world that makes Arab Jewish belonging possible.
Yeah.
And that is the power of reclaiming that. And that's why for me, you know, I also want to stretch my imagination to not just think about Jerusalem, but to think about Baghdad, to think about Cairo, to think about Aleppo, to think about all these beautiful, beautiful, deep cities that had Jewish belonging to them for really long time, like thousands of years. I mean, Baghdad to me is one of the saddest stories, right? I mean, 40% Jewish in the 40s. And now I think Avi Shlem told me there's 3 Jews left in Iraq. Like, it's quite something. But so often that's not even part of the discourse of like...
Yeah.
And I get it, right? Because again, the trauma and the way the anti-Semitism and this and that. But like, why can't we also reimagine Jewish belonging into the Arab world again?
Yeah.
That to me feels right alongside with Palestinian right of return. It also feels like, how do we actually have a multi-religious region that's actually in integrity with our with our lands,
with our lands, with our history, with the desires. Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's hoping for that day. Gosh, it would be a beautiful day to witness and experience. And in some ways, kind of, this is a microcosm of it. This is a snapshot of that day. And I guess we'll continue to try and, I don't know, be part of this new imagining that we'd like to create.
Yeah, you know, what I've been saying to myself over the last few years around this is like vision forward. Like I have to remember what the vision is.
Yeah.
And then I need to remember where I am now and what the reality is now.
Yeah.
And what step can I take to, even if, you know, because sometimes I feel so far away, how can we get, but it is possible. And that's for me where the faith becomes really strong.
Thank you so much for spending this time with me on the show, sharing all of your knowledge, your wisdom, your love and compassion. And also your vision for a brighter future. I think we could all do with expanding our imagination and our hope at such a very dark and difficult time. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Leila, for having me on your podcast and in your home. And yeah, it was such a beautiful conversation, and I look forward to many more.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Check out the show notes for more details about my wonderful guests, including where you can find them on social media. If you enjoyed listening to this, please do spread the good word, share with friends, family, cousins, and colleagues, and please, please, please like and leave a review on whatever platform you are listening to this podcast. Your support is crucial for the show's success, and a couple of clicks from you will mean the world to me. Go to my website, leilamaghribi.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter for more news on future episodes.